Hey, I'm Scott, and I'm an American in Bangkok. Today, I'm going to go into part three of how I moved to Thailand. But first, I want to do a little plug, and this plug is not for any sponsor, not for a friend, not for family, not for you to use me to help you, not for you to buy my photos, but just to tell you that in the very near future, I should finish up the book I've been writing. I've been writing several books, and I'm not the greatest at staying disciplined about it. I've got 10 different things going on at once, and although I should just sit down and dedicate even 15 minutes every day, I don't always do that. So it takes me, it's always taken me longer than I would like to write articles and to write, in this case, the book. But I should be finished quite soon. And the book, I believe, is going to be called They Call Me Farang. And although there will be some of the blog posts in the book, like the story of my friend who blew 90K, I'm going to go into greater depth. There's a lot of things that I either didn't say in the videos or write, or I didn't want to at the time or whatever, but there's a lot more behind the scenes that goes on in my life than people know. And there'll be some things that you don't know about me that I just don't go around telling people. And I don't feel like making videos about. And hopefully you guys will like the book. I've got a chapter that I'm working on, and I might have mentioned it already. And it's The Wisdom of Common Sense. The thing is this chapter is starting to be, it could probably be a short book. Because I originally started with 10 things that you really need to remember when you come to Thailand, and then it went to 25, and now it's up above 50, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I should just make it 100. I don't know if I can think of 100 things, and there's a lot of stuff that is common sense that can be used anywhere in the world, but little things like learning to speak decent Thai before getting into a serious relationship. And I go into why I think that's important. And things like resisting the temptation to be Captain Save-A-Whore. And then, there's all the other things, the little do's and don'ts, don't put your feet up, don't do this, don't do that. And there's stories behind each of these. So I'm not sure if I'm going to incorporate it into the book yet, or I'm going to just make another book out of it. I haven't really decided. As they say in Thailand, sometimes I flip-flop. A lot of flip-flop. I go, one day I want this, one day I want that. One day I want to go to the Central African Republic, one day I want to go to Tibet. And then the next day I'm like, well, the Central African Republic is really expensive. I don't know if I can raise the money. And then the next day I'm, well, maybe I can raise the money. Maybe I should try at least. Maybe I should go there with less money than I think I need. Maybe I should just give in and just do it. Take the step, as I said. Maybe I should get out of the gray zone and get into the black and white zone. So, who knows what will happen, but in the near future, I will be done with this book. I have made a commitment to myself to finish it because I think it's something that's necessary. This is not a book saying, well, if you come to Thailand, the first thing you got to do is get yourself an apartment, and you can do that by doing this. And when you're dealing with immigration, always do this. And when you're doing – it's not a how-to book. It's just – my opinions, my observations, my experiences, and you should be able to learn from them, but, don't expect me to try to teach you things in the book, because that's not what the book is about. And on the other hand, there's a lengthy chapter on women, Thai women, And while I don't profess to be an expert, and honestly, I don't think anybody's really an expert other than women, it's something that needs to be covered because, let's face it, a lot of people like Thai women. A lot of men love Thai women. And it's part of the whole scene. It's part of the country. It's what Thai women are, something that Thailand is well known for, lovely Thai women. So, and also Thai bar girls and prostitutes. So, I got to include that in the book. Anyway, moving on, let me start up. Let me think if I can remember where I left off in the last episode. I was running out of money. I was blowing money, going out, partying, drinking, traveling around, going here, going there, wanting to see the sights. And my bank account got beneath $1,000. And I had no income other than the $1,000 a month that I was promised by my friend in Southern California, who was to pay me. The deal was he'd pay me $1,000 a month for 2 years. And he had been paying me faithfully. And I kind of figured, well, I got this thousand coming. And at the time, that was all the way up to about 52,000 baht a month. So I was able to be, I was living comfortably. And I had no bills, basically. So I wasn't all that worried, but I was just starting to get that twinge of, oh shit, I'm not sure this is such a good situation. And then I tried to slow down a little bit, but I wasn't really doing very well. And I waited for the money to come, and a day passed, and another day passed, and it was 3 or 4 days past the date that he was supposed to pay me. And I don't remember exactly how much I had, but I didn't have very much money. And I had this girlfriend that I had been going out with for a couple of months, and I wasn't paying her, but when we went out, I would usually pay. Once in a while, she would pay, and every once in a while, she liked to party a little bit, and we'd go out, and she'd say, you know, I got 10,000 baht, and I just want to spend it just to go out and party. And I'd be like, well, maybe you should put 5,000 away and stash it and blow 5,000 on partying, but don't blow the whole 10,000. But she would never have that. She wouldn't listen. She would buy her girlfriend's drinks and buy me drinks. And, you know, it was fun, but, you know, I guess I could say I should have known better. She should have known better. Anyway, I can't control her. So, but I started getting really low on money. And then what happened was after a couple of days, I was getting pissed. And I was like, you know what? I got to call this guy up. I got to find out. It's not like him. So I called up at about 3 in the morning after a night out, and his wife answered, and his wife said, well, right now he's with a customer. Can he call you back? I know he wants to talk to you. And I said, well, okay, please have him call me. And I waited and waited by the phone, and about 4 o'clock he called me back. And I said, hey, you know, listen, I've been waiting for my money. Where is it? Well, I got something to tell you. I'm not going to be able to pay you. And I said, what do you mean you're not going to be able to pay me? And of course, I was pissed. I was like, I'm going to come back there. I'm going to break your legs. You know, you're going to pay. You're going to pay me one way or the other. You made a deal. You owe me the money. He said, listen, it's not that I don't want to pay you. I really don't have the money. And here's the deal. When I sold my business to him, I sent out a letter to all the customers. And that letter said, I really appreciate your business. It's been nice working with you, but I've decided to sell the business and move on to something else. So your plates, your artwork, your negatives, they're going to be transferred over to the company that I sold my business to. And if you want the artwork and everything back and you'd like to go somewhere else, that's fine. He will be happy to give this stuff back to you. But if you want to stay with him, he's a great printer. I've known him for a long time. good guy, so give him a chance. And I called some of the better customers and told them, I told them exactly what I was doing, that I was going to move to Thailand for a year and that I needed to do it. I felt that it was, I didn't have much time left to just pick up and leave. And if things didn't work out, I wanted to be able to come back home. And I wanted to still be young or young enough. And so most were very understanding. And but what he told me was that most of the customers didn't want to do business with him. It wasn't anything personal, but they were just of the opinion that, listen, it's my artwork, and I'll choose the printer, and I'll do the shopping around. And a lot of the people, they ended up leaving. They didn't want to stay with him. He figured, what he said to me was, I figured that I would be able to pick up your customer list, your customer base, and at least keep about 75% of them, and I would make money, and it might be slow in the beginning, but in the long run, the investment would pay off, and I would make quite a bit of money, and it would be a worthwhile investment. It didn't happen that way. Maybe 20% stayed with him, and the rest either just left their artwork and never did any more work, or they picked up their stuff and went elsewhere. But by his account, he wasn't making enough money. And the idea was that he would make the money from my customers, that would give him enough money to pay me, and he'd have extra money, and then things would be perfect. Well, they weren't perfect, because he underestimated the loyalty that my customers had to me and to doing things that, the way that they wanted. And he only kept about 20% of the customers, something like that. And then, you know, that was a major problem. But I said to him, listen, you're going to have to pay me something, because, you know, you owe me, I think it was about $13,000. I was like, that's just bullshit. I'm sorry if you can't make it, but you owe me the money. You made an agreement. We shook on it, and this is a gentleman's agreement. I don't care what the story is behind it. You got to pay me, and if I have to, I'll come back and sue your ass. And, you know, I didn't say anything to him like, you know, I'm going to hurt you or anything like that. But in my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to go back, and I'm going to break this guy's legs, because it's just too much money, and I worked too hard for it, and now he's putting me in this position where I'm totally screwed. But the bottom line was that I did it to myself in a way. I mean, yeah, he had a part of it, but I should have went to the bank and said, you know, I need a letter of credit. He needs a letter of credit and a guarantee or whatever it is. And I didn't do that. I didn't make sure of it. And also, you know, I mean, I understood where he was coming from, but, you know, the bottom line was I wanted my money. So I wanted to get something. I said, listen, you know, send me a grand. And at least for now, we'll figure things out later. And about a month later, I got the grand. Well, it's maybe 3 weeks later. I got the $1,000. And he said to me, listen, unless I get the customers back, you're going to have to call all the customers and ask them to please do business with me. I said, man, I'm not going to do that. They can do whatever they want. It's up to them. That was not part of the deal, was that they stay with you. It's up to them. And you knew that. So, you know. So I started thinking, once he sent $1,000, I thought, wow, you know, I don't have much money. I don't have any income. What am I going to do? Should I fly back and try to sue his ass? And then I thought, you know what? I'm going to fly back, and I'm not going to have much money. And it's not going to be an overnight thing where I take the case to court, I sue him, get my money in a week, and boom, I'm on my happy way. That's not how it works. I knew it might take a couple of years for me to get that money. So I thought to myself, listen, I'm going to blow the $1,000 on a ticket to go home, or at least some of it, and to stay in a hotel for a couple of days, because I didn't have an apartment. Maybe I could have stayed with a friend or something for a little while, but I couldn't do that forever. And I thought, it's not worth it for that much money. If it had been a couple hundred thousand or $100,000, yeah, all right, it would have been worth it. So I was shit out of luck, basically. And I started running really low on money. I had that $1,000, and the rest of the $1,000 I had in the bank, by the time the dust settled, I had his $1,000 and that was it. And, you know, I paid my bills, the rent and the electricity and the water and stuff. And I had money for food, but I was thinking to myself, what am I going to do for work? And weeks went by and I'm thinking, I don't know what to do. I'm looking on the internet for things to do. And the one thing I kept seeing was teaching English. And I thought, man, I'm not a teacher. I can't do this shit, you know. I'm like, I don't want to teach English. And I just kind of kept looking for stuff to do. And really, if you're a foreigner and you come here and you want to look for a job, you're either going to do something that's illegal or you're going to do some job that it's a shit job. And I didn't come to Thailand to do a shit job. If I wanted to do a shit job, why would I do it here? I would rather live better in the United States because I knew I had something to fall back on. I had my family. You know, if I had to, I could use a job database for whatever state that I was going to live in and try to find a job that way. I could do all kinds of things. There are options if you're living in your home country. When you're living in Thailand, it's either you sink or swim. You run out of money, you know, you're going to have to go to the embassy and have them repatriate you. And so I was like, whoa, man, I have to get it together. I just don't know what am I going to do. And I was talking to my parents and they were like, oh, well, you know, you're just going to have to come back home. And I was like, oh, man, I don't want to come back home, you know, come on. And I used to go to this place that was in Nana Plaza. It was called Woodstock, and I think it's still around, but it's at a different location. And it was just a pub. It was like an American-style pub where they sold burgers, and there was people played pool. And there was a lot of regular, everyday people in the place. I mean, people that weren't coming to go whoring. They weren't coming to – I mean, this is during the day that people would go in. It'd be 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and there were no go-go bars open or anything like that. At least there was nothing really happening. And people would go in and play pool and shoot the shit and have a nice lunch and then, you know, maybe play darts and then they would leave. Or they would – some people sometimes, because I used to do this, they'd stay there for hours and they would have a drink or two and people would stay and crews of people would come in. There would be different at different times different people would come in. So it'd be like, you know, you're at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you're with a friend and then by 4 o'clock some new friends would come in, hey, what's going on, man? And you know, you ended up staying, you're playing pool all day and all night. And for me, who didn't have anything to do, it was a cheap way to hang out because I'd milk a Pepsi for, you know, 2 hours and it cost me 60 baht. But the thing is that I knew that by being there that at least I was around other foreigners and maybe I could pick their brain a little bit. And I knew this one guy, I'd become friends with him, not real good friends, but I just talked to him once in a while. His name was Les. And he used to teach, I knew he was an English teacher. And he said to me, listen, give it a shot. Try teaching English. You know, I can get you a job. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, go right down. It's right down the street here at Central Chitlong. I said, oh, okay. He said, go talk to the guy. His name is John. He's a Brit. He's all right. I said, okay. And so the next day I went in. Well, I made an appointment and I went in. Of course, I was on time. And I meet the guy and he's, you know, a little short guy, ruddy face, looked like he had been, you know, like he was hungover or he'd been drinking. He had the red kind of like alcoholic look to him. And the first thing he said was, oh, let me show you around. I thought, wow, all right, cool. You know, he said, hey, let me show you here what we got. And it was a big place. And then he said to me, why should I hire you? And I said, I'll come in on time. I won't come in drunk, and I'll do the best I can. Boom, you're hired. I said, hallelujah. Whoo, all right, baby. You know, I pulled it out. Somehow I managed to do it. I got the job and, you know, I got a source of income. Yeah, baby, I can stay. I don't have to go home. And all right. That afternoon I was teaching English. And I got to say, I didn't particularly like it. I enjoy teaching boxing. I enjoy teaching people about Thailand. I enjoy some things. I pass along some knowledge of some things. But I don't enjoy teaching the English language. To me, it's a boring subject, and I just didn't like it. And in fact, you know, the first month I worked there, I made about 26,000 baht, and it was enough. But I mean, it was enough to pay the bills, and I wasn't starving. But that was it. I didn't have anything left over. And then the next month, I think I made 30,000. The month after that, I made like 30,000. And then I think, you know, I worked there for about 4 months. And out of those 4 months, the most I made was like 35,000 baht, which was, you got to remember that the baht was at about 45 or something like that, 45 or 50. So, I mean, this was peanuts, but it was paying the bills. And that is a key to staying here, is that if you want to really stay here for the long time, just make sure you pay the bills. And if you pay the bills, usually if you got half a brain and if you are a little bit hungry and you're a bit of a hustler, you'll figure something out in time. But you got to keep paying the bills, or, you know, you don't want to end up on the street, and then you're screwed. So, I got this job, I'm paying the bills and everything. And then, you know, there's two things I remember about my teaching English. Well, three. One, I didn't really like it. Two, I remember the fat kid sitting in my classroom who, he kind of looked like he wanted to say something, but he hadn't raised his hand, so I didn't call on him. And I'm teaching, and kids are raising their hands, they're asking me questions once in a while, which that doesn't happen very much. But I told them, you know, if you have any questions, please ask me. Don't be scared. And finally, I, you know, the kid keeps looking. He's really antsy, and I'm thinking to myself, what's the matter with this kid? All of a sudden, he shoots his hand up, and he says, teacher, put key. And basically, the kid had to take a shit. He's sitting there holding it, pinching his cheeks together. He's too shy to ask me if he can go to the toilet. And finally, he had had enough, and it looked like he was going to lose it. And he thrust his arm up in the air. And I always remember that poor kid. And I said, yes, go, you know. And then everybody was laughing. And he came back, and everybody was laughing. He had a little look on his face. But these kids were, I think they're around 12 years old, something like that. So they're around the age of my kids now. And the other thing I remember is that near the end of my time as an English teacher, there were two girls that I knew. And they were friends. I mean, they were kind of friends that I'd messed around with and I knew and you know, fairly well. And they said to me, listen, you've been nice to us, and we'd like to take you out for your birthday. I said, oh, cool, you know. So we go out, and they like to party. And I had mellowed out, but I still, you know, once in a while, and now it's quite a bit different. I don't really, you know, I'm not a big drinker. And I, but back then, I was like, what? You're going to buy me all the drinks? Okay, sure, man, cool, you know. And They lined up the shots. They got B-52s and bloody abortions and whatever else there is. You know, shots of tequila, Goldschlager, Jägermeister, just you name it, we drank it. And I ended up shit-faced in some bar, nodding out because I was so drunk. And they dragged me back to my apartment. And the next day I had to go to work and teach. Well, I woke up about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I thought, oh, shit, I'm supposed to teach. Oh, shit, it's 1 o'clock. I already missed my class. No, I didn't miss. They're going to fire me. Shit. And I called up, and I said, was I supposed to teach this morning? Because, you know, I thought it was tomorrow. I'm so sorry. And they said, we got somebody to cover for you. Don't worry about it, you know. I said, okay. Whew, I lucked out on that one. I didn't lose my job. And so what happened then was one of my buddies contacted me. This is the buddy who told me you're out of control. And he had a friend who had a print shop down in, well, he had just bought a print shop in the south of Thailand. And he knew that I had been a printer. And so he said, come on down. I got a job for you. I said, well, how much does it pay? $30,000 plus a place to live, and I'll pay all the utilities. I said, wow, that's probably close to $40,000. I thought, you know, it's not great by any means, but hey, you know, it's better than teaching English. So I gave my notice, and a couple of weeks later, I flew down to Phuket. I had my own apartment. I think it was called the Sky Place. And, you know, it was like, I don't know how many floors, 15 floors, 20 floors. And I was on one of the higher floors, which I didn't like because, I just don't like being up there, especially here in Thailand. If you can, get a floor, you know, like on the first or second floor. Don't get, you know, the 20th floor. It's just, think about it. And anyway, so I started working for the guy. I go in, he's got this print shop, but his machines were complete shit. And when I mean shit, if you know anything about printing or offset printing, you know, there are rollers on the printing press, and those rollers are what carry the ink to the plate that's on. There's a cylinder, and the plate wraps around that cylinder, and the rollers carry the ink to that cylinder, and then there's on the plate, there's places that will carry the ink, and there is a chemical that's rubbed onto the plate that will make the ink not adhere. Well, if the rollers are uneven, or they're swollen, or there's pits or holes or gouges in them, then they won't carry the ink evenly. And his rollers were completely thrashed. And I was like, dude, you can't. This machine is a piece of shit. How are you going to do any business? The thing about printing is this is a – you're using chemicals. This is a science. You need to have at least decent equipment. You can't have garbage equipment. He said, we got to make it work. I don't have any money. I socked everything I could into this thing. We got to make it work. So we rubber banded things together, and we used Velcro, and – I would do things like this is an old trick, but you know, if there's a little spot that doesn't carry the ink real well, you stand there with a spatula, and you just tap a little bit of ink on that spot. You just continue to do that as much as necessary, and in that way, you're putting extra ink on so that it will carry that ink. And we made it work. I mean, we made it work for about a year, but I can't imagine he was making very much money, but he was making enough to pay the bills and pay me, which was at the time, which is all I really cared about. And then the thing is with the guy is that he was never the kind of guy that would be like, okay, I'm there at 8 o'clock and we're working until 5 or until the work is done and that's what we're going to do. No, it would be, I'm going out tonight. You want to come with me? I'll buy the drinks. Okay, sure. I would wake up and go to work at 8 o'clock, hungover. He would sleep in. He would come in at 12 o'clock, and then I would just sit there for 4 hours doing nothing, playing on the computer. Well, obviously, I knew that this wasn't exactly the most efficient way to run a business, and I knew how many orders were going out, and I would figure it out. And I had actually figured out, because I ran a print shop, I ran a department of a print shop, of a company that was a print shop. I ran that department, it was a spa company, for a couple of years, and I knew what it took to be able to make it profitable. And I had told them, this is how much money you got to make at the current prices, and you're only making about, 20%, 25% of what you need to make in order to be profitable and to pay me and to have yourself a little income and give yourself a little income. And it's not working, which I did it out of because he really didn't have a clue. I should have probably just kept my mouth shut, but he was my friend, and I thought, you know, listen, at the end of the day, you know, I don't want the guy losing his ass, and I want him to know where we stand so that we can make any changes that are necessary in order to make the business work. In the end, it didn't work. After a while, he said, I gotta pack it in. This is not going to work. And I said, well, what about me? You got anything for me? You got a little payout? You got a job for me that I can do? What are you going to do? I don't know what I'm going to do. And no, you're on your own. I said, oh, shit. And that was the end of that. And I went back to Bangkok. I had a little bit of money, not much. I was back in the same predicament. And I called my parents and I said, what do you think I should do? And they said, I think you should come home. So I started researching places to come home, and I chose Seattle, Washington. And that is the end of part 3. There will be a part 4. I don't know how much longer I want to go. I don't really want to do my whole life story all the way up to where I am right now. But, you know, I'll do at least one more part, and hopefully you enjoy this one. But until next time, I'm Scott. I'm an American in Bangkok. Chok di lat jerk and mine.